From the Sky News Centre at 5, the economy has taken centre stage in the election campaign as figures show that it only grew slightly in the first 3 months of this year. Tory leader David Cameron has repeated his warning that a hung parliament would damage the recovery, but Gordon Brown has described his election rivals as novices who'd put the country's economic future at risk.
This is a moment of big risks and big choices. Get the choices right and we prosper, get them wrong, and then the bad times return with a vengeance. Ask me my three priorities here and now. April 2010, and I tell you, jobs, jobs, jobs.
Five members of a family have been convicted over the murder of a man whose headless body was found in a lake in Bedfordshire. Michael Gilbert was kept as a slave and tortured for his benefit money. His brother Aaron and his mother Rosalie says he was an easy target.
He wasn't quite wise to people in the way they were and how people would be, or the fact that he could get taken advantage of the money or anything. He was quite kind-hearted.
He'd do anything for anybody.
So
he was too naive.
The High Court's ruled the former head of Children's Services at Haringey Council in North London was lawfully sacked when she lost her job over the baby Peter case. Sharon Shoesmith was dismissed from her post in 2008 after a damning report by Ofsted inspectors. A pilot who was wrongly accused of training the September the 11th hijackers will be given compensation. The Ministry of Justice says Lotfi Raisi is eligible for a payout after the Algerian was held in custody for nearly 5 months. Union leaders have called off a planned strike by AA patrol workers over the May bank holiday weekend. It's to allow for more time for talks in a dispute over pensions. And Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson says there's absolutely no truth in reports that he'll retire at the end of next season. There have been stories suggesting Jose Mourinho is being lined up to take over. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guests to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world are Green Party candidate for Southville Ward in the local elections, Tess Green, and Conservative councillor for Brislington East, who's also chair of Bristol's North and West Planning Committee, Barbara Lewis. Let's have a look at the weather forecast first, though, and this is Bristol's long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight, courtesy of metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging 13 degrees Celsius, which is nice and warm, completely the opposite of what I was forecasting last week, so naughty Met check. Sunny spells with some rain on Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon. Next week, we were averaging 16 degrees Celsius in the daytime, a dry week with plenty of sunny spells. And next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of May, again, 16 degrees in the daytime, sunny and dry, so it looks like a great fortnight coming up. That was the long range weather forecast from the slightly dubious last week anyway metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news now, and joining us is Green Party candidate for the Southville ward in the local elections, Tess Green. Hi Tess, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello Tony.
Now tell us, are you from Bristol?
Well, not originally, but I've lived here probably about 30 years now.
Okay, and what drew you to the Green Party?
Well, I had been a Labour Party supporter for years until Tony Blair was elected, and I realised then that the Labour Party were not going to actually put into practice all the green policies that they'd been talking about, and that's what really disillusioned me, and I realised that I'd better join the Green Party because that's where I really belonged.
Okay, what was it particularly about Tony Blair that irked you?
It was the road building programme, because before they were elected, that Labour Party, their manifesto had said that they would not be building a lot of new roads, and as soon as they got elected, they changed that policy and it became obvious they were committed to building roads.
Okay, so what about you yourself? Do you have a day job? Are you retired or anything?
Well, I'm kind of semi-retired. I'm part of a small business, or two small businesses really. My family brewing business, which is down in Devon, and I'm the company secretary of that. Also my partner's small publishing company, which is local and publishes local history, industrial archaeology, that kind of stuff.
Would you like to advertise the brewing business and tell us what kind of things you're brewing? What brew? Maybe people recognise some of the...
Well, they might, because we do sell in Bristol, but not very often, because we're green and we try and sell most of the beer within 20, 30 miles of the brewery, which is in North Devon in Biddeford. It's called Jolly Boat. And I'm sure people who like real ale will have come across it in Bristol, probably, because we do get into the real ale pubs.
So what's your daily paper? Do you take a daily paper, or what's your favourite newspaper?
Well, I take the Independent online, actually. I'm trying not to have so much paper around the house.
And what do you think about the takeover? Have you noticed any difference since this Russian oligarch bought it for a pound, I think it was, a couple of weeks ago?
No, not really. But, I mean, that's the thing about reading it online. You don't actually see the style of the paper. And I only read the articles which interest me. So I'm very picky about it.
Okay. Now, you're standing in Southville for
that's
the Green
right.
Party,
yep.
Taking over from Charlie Bolton, I think,
yes.
And at least attempting to. Can you give us your pitch why people should vote Green?
Well, in Southville, we face a huge threat from a great big Sainsbury's, massive store, the biggest in the southwest, threatened to be built at the Ashton Gate site if the football club move to the new stadium on the Green Belt site, which is, you know, we don't know it's definitely going to happen, but it's quite likely. And if we do have this huge Sainsbury's, it is going to undermine our local shops, which people value very highly in Southville, and we think it's actually the heart of the local community, a very active community. But apart from that, we're concerned about the traffic congestion that a big new store will bring, the extra air pollution. We haven't got good air quality in that part of Bristol now, and that will be made worse. The traffic will actually make our roads less safe. At the moment, it's bad enough for secondary school kids to go to school from the Southville area. They do have to cross a busy road system, and this is just going to make all of that worse.
Yes, but Bristol City Football Club are saying that they really need a bigger stadium, aren't they?
Yes.
And it would attract maybe more, even World Cup possible matches in the years to come to Bristol.
It may possibly, and it's going to be one or two matches, and I'm not sure that undermining the local community so seriously for two matches is actually fair or wise.
Well, we've discussed this on the programme here quite a bit over the last few months, and one of the things that we've found is that it's actually quite difficult for councillors to go against big developments like this, because they find themselves then, the council will then find itself facing legal challenges from the developers.
Well, that may be, but I think if I'm elected as a councillor, it will be my duty to do the best for my local community, and that's what I shall do.
Okay, now we're also joined by Conservative Councillor for Brislington East and Chair of Bristol's North and West Planning Committee, Barbara Lewis. Barbara, do you want to start by just giving your pitch for why people should be voting Conservative in the forthcoming local election?
One of the things is the economic stability that we want. The Conservatives would freeze the council tax for the next 3 years, which I think would help everybody. We're against building on the Green Belt. We're for a new school in Bristol North West, which is desperately needed there. We're for raising educational standards across the whole board. You know, those are just some of the reasons, generally, within Bristol, why you should vote Conservative.
OK, so just remind us, what's your background? What were you doing before you became a Conservative councillor?
I was a doctor, then I retired, I was a housewife, and then I took up politics about 5 years ago when David Cameron was elected leader of the Conservative Party.
Now, what do you do as the chair of Bristol North West Planning Committee?
It's been quite a horrendous year, actually, chairing that committee. It's the controversial planning applications that come forward. So in Bristol North West, we had the biofuels generator, which was the palm oil plant. We've dealt with the Gloucester Road cricket ground expansion. But on the other side, you have small developments, householders who are objecting to houses being turned into flats. What else? We've had waste plants. We've had biomass generators. It's been a really full timetable. The committee meets once every 6 weeks, but in between that, I'm dealing with planning matters that are going on in the north of Bristol.
Okay, now let's start taking a look at some of this week's stories. And we're going to start today by the big story in Bristol this week, which is all the focus that there's been on the Arnold Feeney last night and the Prime Ministerial Leadership Debate, which was broadcast by Sky and then afterwards on the BBC, on BBC Two and on the BBC News Channel. It just so happened that we had our very own Richard Cowley down there who was reporting for Friday Drive Time. So let's have a little listen to his report. And maybe we could just get your impressions anyway while I'm finding Richard's report. Did you watch, maybe you first, Barbara, did you watch the leadership debate and what did you think of it?
I actually listened to the leadership debate rather than watched it. I thought it was very balanced this time around. I thought David Cameron got the points across. I think some of the gloss was taken off Nick Clegg. I think Nick Clegg was very repetitive. And I thought Gordon Brown was negative. And one of the things that is actually coming out in this campaign, even locally, is the negativity of the Labour Party. Their leaflets are misleading. I won't say blatant lies, but misleading at the moment. You know, Tories will cut concessionary bus fares. Tories will cut free eye services. And none of this is true. And I find that very disappointing. I like to do positive politics. Yeah.
So what about you, Tess? You know, what's your thoughts about having these big leadership debates and the one here in Bristol particularly?
I think it generates a lot of interest from the public, and it's interesting to see how people have reacted to it, and that I'm glad that Nick Clegg has been included because it makes it slightly more interesting. But actually what comes over to me most strongly is how similar they all are and that they're all representing the same agenda. I mean, last night I didn't watch it whilst it was going on because I was listening to Peter Tatchell, who was talking at the Thunderbolt about green policies and what a green agenda would be for government, and that was much more interesting, much more radical, and contained a lot of new thinking, and these three are not coming up with anything new.
Okay, well, we're now able to go over to Richard and his report, which was recorded live yesterday down at the Arnold Feeney.
I'm Brian Harder. Well, the main thing that I'm concerned here is have a peaceful demonstration against the actual immoral war in Afghanistan. What's really shocked me coming here outside the Arnold Feeney is the massive police operation with helicopters, dogs, convoys of police vans, the police boat out. And I wonder in terms of the cost of all this, which the taxpayer is going to end up paying the bill for.
We're going to turn our attention to a small little ruckus, a riot that's just breaking out with the fascists over here, as anticipated.
Which is over the other side of the bridge.
We've just been asked to vacate the area. We're now being pushed behind barriers further and further away. Well, here we are, assembled at the major threshold of trouble. Police are now literally running, sprinting across the bridge here at the Arnold Feeney.
So Richard there at the main threshold of trouble, as he so eloquently put it. What happened there at that point, apparently, was that the English Defence League, who are sort of dressed like football supporters, came along and they were causing a sort of jeering at the crowd. And then some masked up anarchists who were part of the Stop the War demonstration then started throwing rotten vegetables at the English Defence League, and so the police then had to separate the two crowds and did so quite successfully. Anyway, we'll be talking a bit about that a bit more with Martin Summers after the 6 o'clock news, who was down there. What do you think about the these sorts of demonstrations? I mean, you know, it sounds very, do you think it's worthwhile to have a big demonstration outside? Let's start with you, Tess, an occasion like this.
Yes, I do think it's worthwhile because there is a side of this debate that's not being heard. And I think as members of the public, all we can do is have some kind of protest like this to try and bring to the fore the issues that we think are important that the politicians are not talking about.
Yeah, demonstrations are fine, provided they're peaceful, provided you just leave it as shouting at one another. I think aggression is totally off the radar.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it? See, if you're a part of a peaceful demonstration, there's a small group of people with scarves on that start then getting very aggressive.
Well, I'm sorry, it's turn the other cheek, you know, walk backwards. Don't be part of it, because if you do that, you're just like them. I'm sorry, you know, no sympathy.
They were walking backwards, but they were being told to walk backwards and forced to walk backwards by the police horses, apparently. Mm. Anyway, let's have a look listen to the next part of Richard's report.
Get the troops out now!
The way, you know. Police lady on the horse is asking us to move the crowd further back from the river. There's no way actually to go.
Can you hear us, Gordon Brown? You're a long, long way away from us. We're the majority. We want the troops brought back home. Spend the money that you're spending killing Afghanis. Spend the money on schools, on hospitals, on green power.
I'm now talking to rather famous local celebrity Ed Hill, who's been to Palestine a number of times and has a number of DVDs on the market. Ed.
Well, we may not actually squeeze this interview in because the cops are pushing us back at this very moment. Look, I think this is an absolute disgrace. You know, we've got three politicians, one of them will, I presumably, form the next government, and they all want to keep off the real agenda, which is the unjustified and illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for me, as you know, I'm passionate about the Palestinian cause. 62 years the Palestinians have been dispossessed of their land by the formation of Israel, backed by Britain, backed by the United States. They all desperately want to keep off that subject. And to me, support for Israel seems to be part of the DNA of the British government, whichever party is in control. And we're here with our banners, with our placards, with our chants, trying to make that voice heard. And we're just being pushed back by the cops and made invisible. This is what is wrong with this country and so-called democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Ed Hill. We are now literally being physically pushed back, and we are literally being forced back now by horses and a cordon of police.
That was Richard Cowley down at the action-packed Arnold Feeney yesterday. Thankfully, the police did manage to keep a reasonable amount of order, even though there were six arrests, I understand, of the English Defence League contingent who were down there. What about the Palestine issue, Tess? Because that didn't feature at all in the so-called foreign policy debate that was had last night between the three main party leaders.
No, I have to say I agree with Ed Hill. And this is a very important issue that I think a lot of British people think strongly about, and they want much more effort made to actually bring peace to that part of the world, and the current government is not doing anything like enough.
So you would agree with Ed Hills then that Israel should not exist, because that's what he was saying on the broadcast.
Obviously, if you go back in history, Israel was imposed on Palestine. And Palestinians have lost their land, their livelihood, since 1948. And I do know a couple of Palestinians who left at that time and who've never been able to go back. And obviously that is wrong. But it's easy to say that because at the time the thinking was probably very different. Mm. And we've got to deal with what we've got now, and it's no good wringing hands about the past.
No, we could do
a lot more.
We're in a sort of situation where we are. We have Israel. The bit I would agree with the sort of Palestine protesters is the Israelis actually building on Palestine lands. I think that is totally and utterly wrong, and I think we should try and rein them in. I don't necessarily think it's Great Britain supporting Israel. I think it's more America supporting Israel. I think that's where we need to apply the pressure.
But well, what about the substantive issue last night, which was that this was supposed to build as a foreign policy debate, wasn't it?
There was
only actually about probably a third of it which was talking about foreign issues. And I think many of the voters have, you know, really do take issue with the main party leaders over some of these foreign wars, particularly Afghanistan, Iraq, and obviously the Palestine issue.
That is right. And I think people are concerned that more of those wars occurring in the future. They've been wars about resources very largely, and that the same is true between Israelis and Palestinians, that they're fighting over resources. The Israelis have built the wall.
Afghanistan is not a fight over resources. Afghanistan is defending our country. It's getting rid of Al-Qaeda.
But there are sort of issues to do with pipelines and things across Afghanistan and ways of getting oil and natural gas out of Turkmenistan. And there's, I mean, you know, if you can control these territories like Afghanistan, then you've got the ability to actually move, when the Taliban didn't want that.
But it's not British policy to control Afghanistan, it's British policy to try and bring democracy there and get our troops out as soon as we can and to work with the local people there.
Yeah, I think we've got a cheek, actually, because we haven't got a proper democratic system here. Successive governments here have been elected by minority of voters. And that is not democracy, and I don't think we have the right to go into other countries under that pretext of supporting democracy. And I think the whole question of the fight against terrorism has been used to as a cloak for quite different activities, which do include
terrorism is going on here in our own country. It was going on here in Bristol with the bomber that we had here. It was going on in the plane going over to Detroit not so long ago, you know, which had been successful. We would have had another disaster.
Okay, you two, hold it there for a second, because it's time to have Tess's record on. And that was Barbara Lewis just speaking there, who's a Conservative councillor. And I'm going to ask now Tess Green, who's standing for the Green Party in the local elections, to announce her song that she's chosen and tell us why she chose it.
Okay, my song is called Toll Paddle Man, and it's sung by the Red Notes Choir, and I'm a member of the Red Notes Choir, so I'm being a bit cheeky here, but it is a beautiful song, and it's actually telling us the story of the Toll Paddle Martyrs, who probably most of you will think of as the founders in this country of the trade union movement. I think I chose it because things really haven't changed. Although this was almost 200 years ago, workers are still being exploited. Okay, they're not going to be deported anymore. Their wages are not so bad that their children will starve.
They're not sent to Australia, are they?
No, they're not sent to Australia. But the substance of the matter hasn't changed. We've still got this huge divide between the rich and the poor are being exploited. And particularly you see that amongst agricultural workers, which of course the Toll Paddle Martyrs were.
Farewell to my family. It's now I must leave you, but far they will shore. In chains we shall sleep. Although we are taken, do not be mistaken. As brothers in union, we shall be free. They can bring down our wages, starve all our children. In chains they can bind us, steal all our land. They can mock do your duty, be thankful, don't complain, we are taught. For God in his wisdom divided this kingdom, for few to have much, while so many have lost.
together. With an oath we will bind us, the labouring poor in all England shall rise. The Frampton has framed us, they never will tame us. Arise, men and women, we'll yet win the prize. They can bring down our wages, starve all our children. In chains they can bind us, steal all our land. They can mock our religion, from our families divide us. But they can't break the oath of a tall puddle man. No, they can't break the oath of a tall puddle man.
That's song Tall Puddle Man. From the Red Notes Choir. And Tess, can you just tell us a bit about the Red Notes Choir, who they are?
Yes.
Who you are, should I say?
Right. The Red Notes Choir is a socialist choir, which I've belonged to probably 5 years now. We sing songs of peace and social justice. We sing against oppression. We often sing for good causes, like, say, Oxfam, or for Palestine Solidarity Campaign, but a whole lot. I mean, lots of people ask us. Amnesty is another one we've sung for. We sing trade union songs as well, and that was one of those.
So where can people download these MP3s or buy CDs or whatever?
I don't know about MP3s. You could try on our website, which is Red Notes Choir. If you Google Red Notes Choir Bristol, you should get through to us. Or you can find it in some shops. The only one that I know definitely has stocks is the Grant Bradley Gallery in East Street in Bedminster.
Right, now we're going to go back to Richard Cowley, who was actually down at the Prime Ministerial Leadership Debate on Foreign Policy yesterday. So let's hear the final part of that report. And he actually did find a prospective parliamentary candidate down there, who was Paul Smith for Bristol West.
I want to show solidarity with the Stop the War movement. I believe that the war in Afghanistan is misguided, that it's destabilising Pakistan, which is a nuclear state. It's not doing anything about drugs. And it's putting a lot of our young people in danger by sending them out there to fight. I think it'd be much better for this country to withdraw from Afghanistan as soon as possible. All the leaders of the three main parties are backing the Afghanistan war. I think they've sort of backed themselves into a corner, but really they need to reappraise and say, what actual good is it bringing about? People are dying over there. You've got a government that's corrupt, that is being supported. And as I said before, it's destabilising Pakistan, which is an incredibly important country, which also has nuclear weapons.
Now, Tess, I know you broadly agree with that position, but Barbara, you don't, do you? Don't you think it is rather dangerous? Because we could be destabilising Pakistan, being over in Afghanistan, and of course they're a nuclear-armed power, as Paul Smith said there.
Yeah, I think Pakistan was destabilised to start off with, is the problem. I think we need to bring stability to Pakistan. At last, the Pakistan government is actually doing something about Al-Qaeda in their lands. And I think if we can sort of get a pincer movement almost between Afghanistan and Pakistan and squeeze Al-Qaeda out, I think that will bring stability more to that region. If you hear what the Taliban are doing in the north of Pakistan, it's absolutely horrendous.
What are they up to?
Well, they're up to bombing their own people. They're bringing in sort of Shia law, even more sort of radical. They're going around sort of chopping off hands, chopping off heads, suppressing women, suppressing education. This is just appalling. So we need a good, stable Pakistani government there to control that area, and it will help, I think, worldwide terrorism.
But Tess, it must have been interesting for you hearing this prospective parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party being very against the occupation of Afghanistan as an ex-Labour person yourself.
Yes, It was interesting, and you'll probably be in trouble with
so do you support do you support the Taliban then? Do you think we should not be intervening?
Of course I don't support the Taliban. But what I think we should do is think very carefully before we interfere in the politics of other countries. I think the best people to sort out the problems in Pakistan are the Pakistani people, not the...
Which is what they're trying to do at the moment. It's the Pakistani government that's going in with the Pakistani troops to try and sort out the northern territories of Pakistan and quell the Taliban. So,
right.
You know, we've got no British troops in Pakistan.
Okay, so let's leave the subject of the leadership debate, which has been done to death, and the rest of the media. We're not like that. We're sort of a little local media on the side. And let's have a talk. We've got to talk about this Icelandic volcano ash cloud. I'll ask both of you. Barbara, you first. Do you believe in the volcanic ash cloud? Did you believe in it? Do you think it was really there?
Yeah, I did. Well, you could see actually some of the photos. Well, you can see the fumes billowing out from this unpronounceable volcano in Iceland. And I think it was up there. The scientists said it was up there. The Met Office said it was up there. I think you have got to take it at face value. You know, would you have risked putting an aeroplane up there for it to come, you know, its engines to get snarled up and for it to come crashing down?
So the precautionary principle which was being invoked there, wasn't it? But I mean, what's the sense in having, I mean, if you had that sort of precautionary principle, maybe you'd never even cross the road.
It's a little bit too much of a precaution.
I don't think it was.
I think until people actually went up there and tested it in nice empty planes, you know, to see actually how much dust was up there. I think that part of the problem was that the meteorologists could actually see the dust cloud with their instruments, but they couldn't actually measure its true thickness. The dust cloud was there. If my sort of car parked outside is a nice sort of dusty colour now, and I reckon dust has been falling down onto it. I reckon it's definitely there. And what they've decided now is that there still is a dust cloud up there, but the dangerous particles are mainly over Iceland, not spreading over the rest of Europe. But I think at the time they were right to do this. It has caused chaos, but you know, life will sort itself out.
Okay, Tess from the Green Party, what are your thoughts on the dust cloud? Were you rejoicing to see the aeroplanes being grounded?
There was a bit of me, of course, that was rejoicing, and I think that's been the interesting thing, that people particularly who live near large airports have certainly been rejoicing because they've been able to enjoy their gardens, which they can't normally because of the smell of aviation fuel. So that, you know, that's a good thing, I suppose. And I think it's also a lesson to us that the natural world is not always predictable, and that we can't control it and we have to go with it. And I think it is right that we applied the precautionary principle. I mean, nobody would thank us if the Met Office said, oh, well, there is a cloud, but it's probably going to be okay if you fly, and then planes fell out of the skies. That risk couldn't be taken.
But what's the point of having a safety regime, as there was in place with this volcanic ash, when you don't actually know what levels of ash are safe?
Well, that's the bit about the unpredictability, isn't it? This is not something that happens very often, that a volcano actually occurs near very populated areas where there are many flights. And so we haven't had many chances to actually tackle the problem, and now we have. I'm sure next time it will be responded to more quickly and probably more rationally. But
well, now they've done the tests. They actually were doing the tests last weekend, the Civil Aviation Authority, with their planes flying up into the cloud, deliberately into the most dense parts of the cloud, to then come back down, have a look at the engines and see if there were any dust particles in there, and at what point the engine was then chucking these dust particles out, or at what point they were starting to accumulate and choke up the engine. So it just seemed a bit crazy to me that they've got these safety procedures, but then they have to actually go and find out what level is safe halfway through the fact that, you know, complete shutdown virtually of European airspace.
Yeah, but as Tess says, you know, next time we'll know better. And wasn't there a plane that flew through a volcano in New Zealand and literally did start to tumble out of the sky? Now, I'm afraid I'm not prepared to risk people's lives on this. So, you know, we've done it, we're learning from it, next time it might be slightly different, but you know, for heaven's sake, let's be safe.
And I'm hoping this will alter people's attitudes to flying, because we have got to fly less.
But it might bankrupt a few airlines, mightn't it?
Well, yes, I shan't be too unhappy if that happens, I have to say.
Yeah, but you know, you've got to be a realist here. People like to go on holiday, they like to lose aeroplanes, people need business flights, goods come in, because one of the things that I noticed was the goods coming in from Kenya. The Kenyan farmers were having a horrendous time because all their goods are flown in, so they couldn't get the flowers in, the roses in, the beans that we all like to eat from there. And I know you're going to say, as a Green, well, we shouldn't be doing that, but actually we're supporting
we shouldn't.
We're supporting the Kenyan economy out there.
Well, I don't think it is. We've had distorted the economy of many developing countries to suit our own ends, and for us to eat beans at all times of the year when we can eat our own beans during the bean season seems to me a very selfish thing to do, and that we should leave developing countries to feed their own people first.
I'm sure the hundreds of thousands of people that are employed in Kenya feeding the rest of the world will be very pleased with that statement.
Now, do either of you know anybody who was trapped in this personally, who got caught abroad or couldn't fly abroad?
Yes, it's not quite interesting because he's a Green Party member.
Oh, no, he wasn't booked on an aeroplane.
He hasn't flown for 10 years. And he was persuaded that he would take his kids on a holiday to Spain, and as far as I know, he's still in Spain.
Right, that's I'm appalled to hear that the Green Party are booking airplane flights willy-nilly.
That's ironic.
I suppose one every 10 years.
I don't think willy-nilly is once in every 10 years.
Once every 10 years is pretty good, isn't it? How often do you fly, Barbara?
The last time I flew was about... Where are we now? About 18 months ago, and it was to go on holiday, and my husband and I had a wonderful time exploring Jordan.
So, Tess, are you against people flying on holiday with their family maybe once a year?
I think people should think very carefully about it. It's much better for the British economy, for a start, for people to take their holidays here. We've got people geared up for tourism.
But there's a good old
here.
British weather, isn't there? You can't really rely on it.
We can't rely on it, but we won't be relying on it anywhere if we carry on the way we are, putting more climate changing gases into the atmosphere. And that's why we need to think carefully about flying. We need to, all of us, reduce our flying.
Yeah. Okay, now I want to move on to talk about a couple of quite controversial local-ish stories to do with the election campaign. First one is from the Swindon Advertiser. Gordon Brown's visit to Swindon turned into a political farce after the Tory-controlled Swindon Council barred journalists from accompanying him on a visit to a primary school. Conservative-controlled council and the National Labour Party became embroiled in a political fight over access to Drove People's Campus. A planned press conference inside the school had to be hastily rearranged, and Mr. Brown was forced to speak to waiting journalists from the side of the road. Now, Barbara, I'm going to start with you, because this is a Conservative council and you're a Conservative. Isn't this a little bit naughty for the local council to stop any kind of filming of Gordon Brown when he goes into a school?
No, not at all. I think they would have stopped any politician that had gone in. There are certain rules that you abide by whilst you're politically campaigning, and one of those is that you can go into schools, you can talk to the school kids, but you don't use it as a sort of electioneering with the press forum. So I think Swindon would be quite correct to do that. I think if he came to Bristol and tried to go into one of our primary schools, and this is a Lib Dem control council, I'm sure the same reaction would have happened here.
Tess?
I must say I don't like the sight of politicians using schools, nurseries, hospitals for political purposes. I don't think they should be doing that. So I've got no problem with this, really, as long as every party is treated equally.
So do you think that, in this situation, that the cameras should have been allowed in to film Gordon Brown in the school? I mean, after all, it is a public property, isn't it?
It is, but I think we've got to be very careful about disrupting children's education, and it could be very disruptive, a prime ministerial visit. So again, yeah. You know, why don't we leave the schools to get on with it?
Okay, next story. This is from the Bath Chronicle. The Conservatives are trying to shut down a website. This is lampooning an Eton educated parliamentary hopeful, a Labour supporting Bath student, set up a spoof site which takes the mickey out of 40-year-old pension fund manager Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's standing as a Conservative candidate. Now, what about this issue? It's a bit of a thorny one, isn't it? He set up a site pretending to be his, even though there are some pretty good clues in there that it's a spoof site. Tess, let's start with you. Do you think this sort of thing should be allowed?
Well, I think we've got to keep our sense of humour. And this is, as you say, it's a spoof, and there's loads of clues to show that it's a spoof. It's like April the 1st, when we have these false reports of money trees or something like that, which some gullible people may fall for, but most people don't. I think we should take this a bit lightheartedly.
What about you, Barbara, as he's from your party?
I don't actually know Jacob, but I think it's going a little bit too far, because actually if you read the address... the website, it's jacobreesmogg.org.uk. It looks as if it's a genuine website, and I think some people probably will be taken in by it. It's not the kind of campaigning I like. I don't like these personal campaigns.
But when he says I'm not allowed to speak to ordinary people, it tends to upset them. That's one of the quotes from the site. People surely must realise that this is not a real election site. You know, that as soon as you see it, I mean, this is an increasing trend, isn't it? There are sort of spoof websites put up about all sorts of these big powerful corporations like Exxon, people posing as Exxon executives.
But actually, in the local press, we've had something recently. There's the sort of, on the Evening Post, there's a blog site, and there's somebody writing in there as Conservative spokesperson. Now, we have absolutely no idea who this person is. It's nobody authorised by our party, but they're supposedly spousing Conservative views, which they're not. Mm. Now, that is being mischievous. That's not playing it correctly.
It's a bit of a fine line, isn't it, between, a sort of satirical thing and actually really pretending to be somebody. Yeah. So that's a difficult line to draw. I'm not sure if we can do it here and now. Mm. But anyway, it'd be interesting to see if that site is there. Maybe people would like to try it on the internet and make their own mind up. It's called, just to give you the website address again, and you may find nothing at all there, but it's Jacob Rees-Mogg. With 2Gs .org.uk. Anyway, it's time for Barbara to introduce her song. Barbara, would you like to do that now?
My song, it takes me back to my teenage days and the years of protest. It's a Bob Dylan song. It's The Times They Are A-Changing.
Could you just tell us why you chose it?
Because, it's the kind of sort of when you're in your teens and your early 20s. I was in the late 60s, early 70s. You listened at university to a lot of sort of Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and James Taylor, all these, and it just reminds me of good times that I had back then.
Come gather round, people. Wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing. Writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. 'Cause the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing. The mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times they are a-changing. Drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
Yes, Bob Dylan there with The Times They Are A-Changing. The choice of Barbara Lewis, a Conservative councillor for Brislington East, who's joining me now. Let's move on to our review of the news, and also mustn't forget to mention Tess Green from the Green Party, who's also with me. This next story is about a fraud probe which is being launched into £52 million worth of handheld bomb detectors which were sold to the British Army in Iraq that do not work, allegedly, anyway. And this has now come to court, this case, and it's all about some chap called Jim McCormick, 53, Managing Director of Somerset-based business ATSC, who's been selling these devices, and it was that one of them was taken apart, and it was discovered that actually there was nothing really in there that would detect bombs, which they were supposed to do. Now, this is an extraordinary story, Barbara, isn't it?
Absolutely horrendous. I don't think it was British troops, as you were saying, were using it. I think it was the Iraqi government security.
No, we handed it over to the Iraqis to use.
We handed it over to the... Yes, I think that's what it was. You know, my question here is, why weren't these devices tested before they were actually sent out to see if they worked? You know, particularly, you say they were sent out to British troops. I think they were actually sent out to the Iraqi government. But why didn't we, somewhere, someone, test that they actually worked before we gave them an export license?
Somewhere down the line, something's gone horribly wrong here. What do you think? Are there any lessons to learn? What lessons we might learn from this?
Well, as I say, I think things that we're sending to you know, particularly this kind of bomb detections equipment, we've got to actually make sure that it works.
Tess, had you come across this story before, or you just read it there?
I've just read it now, and obviously it's an appalling story. It's a very sad story because lives may have been lost unnecessarily.
Absolutely.
That could have been saved if this thing worked properly. Mm. And it's quite right that there's a proper investigation into this, and that the firm should be prosecuted.
Well, surely the lesson must be something to do with the way that we have government procurement systems.
Yeah.
I mean, what can anything actually be done to tighten these kind of procurement systems up, do you think?
Yeah.
Either of you?
Surely, you know, I don't know how the systems work, but this has obviously been a great flaw in the system. You know, you learn the lesson, and you go back and you put something in that's anything that is sold, you know, particularly this kind of bomb detecting stuff, or anything that's sort of scientific that says it's, you know, it will do A on the packet. You make sure that it actually will do that before you give it an export license and let it go.
They were making claims apparently for these devices that they can detect explosives or narcotics even if hidden inside containers, frozen fish, airtight containers, and the human body. So they were making amazing claims for this thing. You'd have thought they were twigged somewhere.
I would have thought so.
Yeah,
it shows how low people will go to make a bit of money.
Yeah.
And we do need the regulations to be tightened up, and we do need to make firms responsible when they act irresponsibly like this.
52 million, apparently, public money was spent on these things.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what a test. As someone who's sort of from the outside coming into, quite fresh maybe, into the government system, I mean, even if it's only locally here in Bristol, what would the Green Party do to tighten up on these government contracts?
I think they need to be tightened up enormously. I mean, the Green Party actually wouldn't get in. Don't think that we should be selling armaments abroad. That's another thing. I know this isn't an armament. This is not. It hasn't got military use. But certainly, firms should be held to account if they sell faulty goods. And this kind of selling is obviously very important. That we get it right. We don't. Yeah. We don't allow exports of things that could cost lives.
But I would suggest a lot of those procurement systems, you've got commercial confidentiality involved, and I mean, there needs to be a little bit more accountability and openness, I would say. Right, next story, which is probably the most horrific story of this week, even though it actually started, what it was, it 2 years ago. A man's body was in a Bristol flat for 10 years. His decomposing body lay undiscovered in a council flat in Bedminster for almost a decade, and we hear that that his fully clothed remains were found when council workers were sent to clear out the flat on January the 31st, 2008, after Mr. Derrick had been made subject of a county court order. Former council warden Sandra Wedlock said Mr. Derrick had requested not to receive regular warden visits and said none of the wardens or tenants were aware that Mr. Pring was living in the flat as a lodger. When she visited the flat with colleagues in 1999, in response to complaints about the smell, they were even warned that there may be a dead body in there, but failed to see it in the lounge. How on earth can this kind of thing happen, Tess?
I think this is a very strange story, and it says a lot for the workers who went to that flat that they didn't decide that the smell needed to be investigated further. I mean, it has some civil liberties overtones, because obviously it's difficult for the council to go into somebody's home if they don't want that to happen. But I think with the kind of reports they've been having from neighbours, they should have investigated it more thoroughly.
I agree totally with that. It's an appalling story that's gone on. I think this is sort of neglect by the council. I think if you saw the photographs of the man's flat, it was an absolute tip. There were sort of social problems, environmental problems. I am sure the council could have gone in and cleaned the, you know, you can make orders and get the flat cleaned, particularly if there were smells coming from it, and I think then the body would have been discovered. I think they've sort of probably said, oh, this is a little bit of a difficult man, we won't disturb him, just let him get on with his life. It's not the right attitude to have at all.
Well, it sounds amazing to me. Apparently, when his lodger died, Mr. Derrick just literally tipped the sofa over because he was afraid. He didn't really want anyone to know that he was in there and wanted to forget about it. Now, it does seem to have a lot of overtones of possibly, anyway, of mental illness, this case. And it may be symptomatic of the sort of care in the community, this whole approach of getting mental patients and actually saying, giving them a little bit of extra money, but saying, oh, you can look after yourselves in the community. What do you think, Barbara? Do you think it may be a case of someone that should have really been in mental care, but there wasn't a place for them?
I don't know. I don't know the whole full facts of that. The giving money to people to look after themselves, care budgets, has only recently come in. I don't think it was probably in existence when Mr. Pring, wasn't it, died. I think it's good that people are actually kept in their own homes. I think it's good that they have control over what the kind of care that they have, but you have to keep an overall watch and monitor to make sure that they are actually being looked after.
But this care in the community was actually brought in, I remember very well, by Virginia Bottomley, I think, in the John Major Conservative government.
But not the actual payments, which is what you mentioned. That has just been a recent addition. So.
Okay, Tess, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think
story?
It's tragic that this man was not offered more help. I don't know how much help he was offered. He might have rejected all of it. But when there are persistent complaints from neighbours, and when a person consistently refuses help, I think more effort needs to be made. I mean, I've worked for social services, and I think in most cases more efforts would have been made, and I think this is one of those cases where it slipped through the net. And
It seems there's less and less places for mental patients and less places for elderly people as well. Where is this all leading?
Well, there are less places for elderly people, but elderly people, actually, they don't want to go into residential care. You know, if you do survey after survey, what they want to do is stay in their own home. So what we need to do is actually put the facilities in there so that they can.
What about this thorny issue, which has come up quite a few times in the last year or so, over people having to sell their homes in order to pay for their care? What's the Green Party's position on that, Tess?
Well, we don't think that's right. We ought to have the system as they've got in Scotland, where people are entitled to free care in their declining years, if that's what they need. Obviously, if people want to remain in their homes, every effort should be made to support them in their own homes. But not everybody does, and there aren't enough decent care facilities for people who need to be looked after 24 hours a day. And I know that from an experience with a close neighbour of mine.
Can you tell us a bit more about that, without naming names?
Yeah. I mean, she was a really kind of stoic kind of person, and she didn't see herself as old for very many years, although she was well into her 80s when she had a fall, and after that she never really recovered, and she needed to go into a home, and she wasn't really treated very well. She had no close relatives, and she was dumped in a home which was supposed to be assessing her needs, and really it was just somewhere for her to live until they could find a private home, which she didn't like very much and had to be moved again, and it was all very sad.
Barbara, what about that point there, though, that which is quite, I think, is quite a valid one, is that some particularly elderly people, maybe even more if they're single, are really kind of almost in denial about the fact that they do need more care, and they want to stay in their home because they want to kind of keep the old situation going where they were more mobile and more able to cope.
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. Can I say what we actually are doing in Bristol?
Yep.
Is we're building very sheltered housing, and we're building a lot of it. And this is superb accommodation. The one I know best is actually in Fishponds, in Colliers Court. These are individual flats. They're wardens, they're nurses. You get 24-hour care. Absolutely wonderful. And I would much rather elderly people went into that, and they're actually being built all over the city. We're going to have about 600 beds of these very sheltered housing accommodation. So I think that's a good thing that is happening.
Okay, last story of the day. Arriva takeover bid revives foreign takeover row. This is Arriva Trains, who are being taken over by Deutsche Bahn. They're going to buy the UK bus and train operator. And it's threatening to become an election issue, allegedly. So essentially, this is really about foreign ownership. And, you know, it does make me wonder whether it was the wisdom of the privatisation of our public services in the first place for them then to be taken over and run and controlled from abroad. What are your thoughts about this story, Barbara?
Well, actually, I find it quite fascinating, because there was all the fuss and the noise when Kraft took over Cadbury's. And, you know, everyone said new rules, etc. And I spotted this the other day in the paper, and I thought, everybody's been quiet on this, but it's exactly the same situation. We've got a foreign firm coming in, taking over a British firm. What we should do about... Well, you talked about privatisation. Well, we are where we are with privatisation.
You have to be really quick on this one, please. Just wind up what you're saying there.
Right, OK.
And Tess, go on, Tess, you have a go.
Well, obviously the Green Party don't agree with privatising public services, and we would take the railways back into public ownership, because that's the most efficient way.
Would the Conservatives do that, Barbara?
No, we wouldn't, because we can't afford it. You know, they are actually run quite efficiently now. You've got to remember back to the...
Sorry, Barbara, I have to stop you. We've got the news coming
like
up. But
you
thanks ever so much, both of you, for coming in. That's Tess Green from the Green Party. And the last person speaking there was Barbara Lewis from the Conservatives.
For Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.